Dr. Giddings has discussed with us the possibility of donating his 200-year-old cello to the School of Music once he passes away. He has recently given a gift of much of his chamber music to us. These must have been absolutely heady days, in my opinion, for the fine arts faculty and students. The faculty was strong and desired strongly to improve. At great personal and family sacrifice, they were enabled to travel to receive further education. In the fall of 1923, B.F. Larson set out for the Académie Julienne, I think is how you would say it, it's close to that, a private Parisian art school established in the 1860s. Asked by the Daily Herald why he was traveling to Paris, Larson replied, "In Paris, an artist is able to get the point of view of the best painters in the world." He took the trip in, I'll come back to this slide in just a second. Florence Jefferson Madsen, her husband Franklin, and their three children set off to study at the Chicago Musical College in 1925. Traveling by car, they suffered 14 flat tires along the way and had a car fire just outside of Decatur. Through their studies in Chicago, they formed long-lasting relationships that took them back to Chicago every summer for almost two decades. 4 years later, B.F. Larson took a second sabbatical, a painting trip to France, Spain, and Morocco. Now, all of you art faculty, don't get any ideas here, and you music faculty too, they went far too often, in my opinion. It was unbelievable. I'm having fun with you. Larson took his second sabbatical and painted these two works, among many others. In fact, during this year of 1929, he painted roughly a third of his oeuvre, his output. Not only that, his work experienced a significant stylistic shift. This is not a painting from that period, but representative. He said, "I may completely change my style into that brutal, ugly type of painting, which my family and friends at home dislike so much." In 1930, it was Robertson's turn. He headed out with his family in their 1930 Whipple. I could only find a picture of a 1929 Whipple, to study music with Ernst Bloch in San Francisco. Bloch was, a wonderful composer who had agreed to be in San Francisco for 6 months, and Leroy wrote him and made arrangements to study with him. Turns out he got there, and Bloch left after 3 months. So disappointed, Leroy took another sabbatical in 1932 to study with Bloch in Switzerland. Traveling with him was one of his students, J.J. Keeler, who was going to Germany to study organ. Robertson spent a full year in Europe studying, attending concerts, and composing. On his return, he brought a tremendous enthusiasm and commitment that lifted the music department and the orchestra. Robertson conducted the choir and orchestra in St. Bach's Matthew Passion in 1936 in the Provo Tabernacle. The orchestra toured throughout the region, including trips as far north as Rexburg and south to Cedar City. They were heard on national broadcasts, as were the choirs, and played significant pieces from the literature. They had significant guest artists come as soloists. Meanwhile, Robertson's work as a composer caught on. His quintet for piano and strings won first place in a nationwide contest, and he was elected to membership in the Society of Arts and Sciences in New York. Many other successes followed, and he continued his work. He'd studied in New England, but he realized it was not an academic degree, and so he pursued getting a master's and later a doctorate, where he studied at USC under Arnold Schoenberg for a period. During the 30s, the late 30s, he began to work on his second symphony, titled Trilogy. It was a sprawling work. Robertson determined he would never hear it in his lifetime, but he continued to compose as the music demanded, without regard to the impracticality of the instrumentation or the difficulty of the music. Trilogy was finished in 1939, and Robertson moved on to other important compositional projects. In the spring of 1945, Conrad B. Harrison, then the music critic of the Deseret News, informed Robertson of an orchestral composition contest, and he encouraged Robertson to enter his piece Trilogy. Robertson was very reluctant. He was busy with other projects. The contest required two copies of the score, and the score was enormous. It could not be copied in Utah. But Harrison insisted and persisted until finally Robertson agreed to give it a try. He sent his only score to New York City and had a friend make two photostat copies, send in the other materials. They arrived. They were posted just before the midnight deadline. Over 2 years went by, and Robertson heard nothing. He sent a letter requesting his materials be returned to him, which was answered with the news that the contest was actually still in play due to an overwhelmingly large number of entries. The results of the judging were to be announced on a nationwide ABC Sunday night radio show on November 2, 1947. On October 31st, Robertson received a puzzling phone call asking him to confirm his name, address, citizenship, and employment. The caller then hung up. Sunday at noon, he received a phone call from a friend in New York City saying, "Have you heard the news? You won." But Robertson had heard no official reply. At 4 p.m. that Sunday afternoon, having waited at home and missed his church meetings, and in the midst of quite a snowstorm, a young man knocked on the door and delivered a telegram. It said in part, "Please accept my personal and heartfelt congratulations on the occasion of your selection as the first prize winner in the competition for the Reichhold Symphonic Award for the Western Hemisphere. Best personal regards, Henry H. Reichhold." The prize was $25,000. 400 musicians from 17 countries had submitted scores. The family gathered around their radio that evening to hear the broadcast announcement, and thereafter the phone rang literally off the hook. The premiere of the work was given the next month, December 1947, by the Detroit Symphony, and the Utah Symphony immediately followed up with the performance the next month, January 1848. For over 20 years, Robertson had laid a wonderful foundation, along with all of his colleagues here at BYU, for multiple reasons, not the least of which was his developing association with the Utah Symphony and its new conductor, Marisa Bravanel. He chose to leave BYU and accept the position of chair of the music department at the U of U beginning July 1948. While composed, the premiere and recording of his famous Book of Mormon oratorio were yet to follow. While a more official unveiling and hanging will be made later by the School of Music, we are happy to announce today that Marian Robertson Wilson, Robertson's daughter, who cannot be with us today, and Francis and Constance Madsen of Salt Lake City have gifted to us a beautiful portrait of Leroy Robertson, which we would like to share with you now. Can we have the lights up? You're the lights, aren't you? Okay. Yeah. This portrait was made from the photograph on the screen and depicts Robertson holding his prize-winning trilogy score at his home in 1947. It will hang in the School of Music. It was painted by the wonderful portrait painter Alvin Gittens, who himself was a BYU alumnus and went on to teach at the U of U and served there as chair of the art department. Gittens has painted many, many portraits, including the portrait of DeYoung, which hangs in the south entry to the DeYoung Concert Hall on the main floor. The story of Robertson and the early days of BYU, I think Robertson in particular, the way I framed it today, is in many ways an iconic story. Talented farm boy goes east, becomes well-trained, returns to teach at BYU, builds a very strong program, works hard, wins international acclaim. I believe in this story, the Robertson story and all of these collective stories, each of us can find some portion of ourselves. Volumes could and should be written and said about those who have gone before us, who have with tremendous faith in the mission of this institution and at significant personal cost built this college. I have focused on a largely music-oriented story, but that is not to signal its importance over the other arts or that of communications. They are significant stories and would require hours to tell. I believe for us to go forward, as we were so strongly and graciously and beautifully invited yesterday, improving on what we do here is dependent on a greater knowledge of our past. So we are announcing this morning that a new website has been created called history.cfac.byu.edu. This site is powered by Wiki software, the same software that runs Wikipedia, which is the online encyclopedia that now contains over 4 million entries in multiple languages, all of those entries having been written by the community of its users. We are inviting you and our students, alumni, and friends to write the history of the arts and communications at BYU. Like our aim and mission to strengthen students' faith, this history will declare the faithful efforts and accomplishments of those who have lived it. Anyone will be able to read the history, but to edit or add new entries, users must authenticate using a BYU NetID and password. And for those who don't have one, there's a link that will allow them to obtain one, even if they're not students or faculty. We wanted to populate this wiki with just one entry, and we have chosen today to honor Alexander Basil Dureis, longtime faculty member in the Department of Visual Arts, who died earlier this month. His family has graciously contributed this remembrance of him, which we have included as the first and only entry thus far in this wiki. Alex was a special person, and those of you who knew him and had the privilege of working with or alongside him would attest to that. We hope in the coming months that hundreds of people contribute to this knowledge, months and years, that hundreds of people contribute to this knowledge base about our college. The Department of Communications' recent history, written by Alf Pratt, has valuable information and insights that could appear here. Or a former chair of communications, Oliver Smith, who wrote a history completed in the 60s, should certainly appear here. Photographs, video content, and personal recollections of many kinds will undoubtedly be added. I would invite each department to consider offering a class that engages students in related research related to its history, and that research find its place at this site. We have talked about history, and now it's our privilege to talk about prophecy. And so we'll take just a short standing break, and within 3 to 4 minutes, we'll begin the panel discussion of President Kimball's talks. After we do that, I'll have just a couple of very brief remarks to close and announce the rest of the program at that point. So let's have the lights up, and you can stand and stretch for just a second.